Welcome to the Aerospace Advantage podcast. I'm your host, John Slickbaum, and given all of the recent activity in space, whether discussing the expansion of small satellites or new launch players like SpaceX, Virgin Galactic, or Blue Origin, it's hard to remember that the space industry was once the realm of only a few select companies. Simply put, the barriers to entry were simply incredible, and the notion that startups or outside companies could enter this realm seemed impossible. But then something happened. Several years ago, the government signaled they wanted to broaden the market for players in the launch sector and as well of those who built satellites. It wasn't long after that decision we saw a tidal wave of activities. And it's fundamentally reshaped what it means to go to space, what we do when we have assets up there, and how we envision this domain. So today, we're going to take a few steps back in history and talk to a number of key players who lived through this journey from both a government and industry vantage point. We are going to explore what drove the government to begin pursuing this course and what motivated companies to want to engage. It's an incredible story, and I think we're going to look back years from now and realize this was a key inflection point that shaped how America and the rest of the world was related to space. Now, to kick off this conversation, I'd like to introduce you to one of the most knowledgeable people I know when it comes to space. He's engaged throughout the enterprise, both in government and on the outside, which really gives him a unique perspective. So with that, let me welcome Chuck Beams. He's currently the executive chairman of York Space Systems, as well as the chairman of SmallSat Alliance. And from 2009 to 2013, he was a senior executive at the Pentagon, responsible for all space and intelligence acquisitions. He also spent 23 years in uniform as an Air Force space and intelligence officer. So with that, Chuck, thanks for being here.
Thanks, Slick.
To kick this off, walk us through the olden days. What was the space business environment like at the turn of the century? When I look back at that era before, it seemed like you could count the number of major players in space on one hand. The government had a list of known actors and they were the go-to players.
Yeah, you know, it's funny. It really has changed a lot. And my history actually goes back before the turn of the century. But you're right. Around the turn of the century, there were just a handful. What they did largely was they just reacted to government RFPs. If the government said the government did some analysis on requirements, it was a very, very sequenced sort of serial process. And then these standing contractors, there were only a handful, they would respond. And largely each of them were kind of had a strength in a particular mission area. What's interesting though, is before that period, during the actual Cold War, there were actually lots of space companies. There were lots and lots of them, but at the end of the Cold War, all through the 90s, the government, in hindsight, I think almost everybody agrees that was a mistake, but they allowed this consolidation to only that handful he talked about. And that was really became part of the problem, part of the problems that plagued the early 2000s was there were only a handful and there was a lack of innovation and stuff.
So Chuck, what changed? I mean, you were in government during this period, and when it comes to defense space, the industry really responds to the customer. In this case, it was the government. So what caused folks in the Air Force and beyond to want a broader slate of actors?
Well, you know, there were a few different things that sort of all came together at the same time or nearly the same time. One was you had a lot of billionaires that were coming of age that had grown up during the great space age as kids, and they were inspired by that, and they were sitting on piles of money. I worked for one of them. For a number of years, Paul Allen, and I managed his portfolio of space things. And the big one there was in 2003 was his throwing his hat in the ring for the X Prize, right? The Ansari X Prize. That was a big deal because basically that was the first ambition of saying, hey, can we do a private spacecraft to carry astronauts, like completely not government related? That was a big deal. And that was successful. That was what led the fund. You know, we led the funding for the early rounds of Black Sky, which was part of space flight and space flight two and all that stuff. But very much that came as a result of frustration that the government wasn't able to, for any number of reasons, was not able to actually address these things in any kind of timeline other than decades. And he saw that the oceans getting depleted. And that was a big thing. On Branson's side, he thought, He's the travel and leisure guy, right? And he thought, you know, private space travel would be a really cool thing that people would want to do. And people said, you can't do that. And he said, well, watch me, you know? And so Paul funded the first one, the Spaceship One with, you know, White Knight One and that whole thing, and developed all the technology for that. And then Branson licensed that and built out this commercial space line we call Virgin Galactic today. But that's how those things happened. And I think it's an important lesson for folks to take from that just because somebody tells you it can't be done, you know, the really clever people, they figure out a way to make it happen anyway, right? And that's the story of the entrepreneur, as you well know. But one of the things that doesn't get talked about a lot is that, because now it's a question of, okay, how should the government deal with this, right? But they really had to force them, all these new private space companies, they had to force themselves into the business. And that's not just because of the competitors, like the handful that we talked about, but also the government itself was very resistant to allowing these commercial companies. And that's changed dramatically. Government now is finally, but it took lawsuits, frankly. It took a lot of guts on the part of these new companies to sort of force their way into that world.
No, and I lived that myself on the personal side, being part of a startup that provided fighter jet training to the DOD. And one of the things that we would have to say in pitch meetings was the fact that only governments could put rockets in space or fly fighter jets, but there are private companies that are doing it at a massive cost savings to the taxpayer. And that's where the rubber met the road for us when it came to being successful. So I totally understand what you're talking to. And it is a monumental paradigm shift to get through the government. So sticking to space, though, I want to make an important note that there's a huge difference between companies that provide the launch services, you know, the actual rockets that are getting the payloads to space, and all of the new firms that are building satellites to operate in orbit. So can you describe the difference between how those two market dynamics evolved? And, you know, we've seen a major expansion in both sectors.
Yeah, it is an interesting one. And as you know, I run an industry group called the Small Sat Alliance, and it includes all the different sectors of the new, what people call the new space arena. But they are different. When you get down into the business models and all that, they are different. And I think that, we've talked a little bit about the launch thing already. The rocket science really hasn't changed. There's been some innovations there, but even with SpaceX, the big thing with him was reusability and just applying principles of manufacturing and putting engineering into cost reduction rather than purely just performance. Those kinds of things were big. With the satellites, as I mentioned before, Moore's Law, private investment has been big. I think that where the two are related is in the satellite business, it's enabled more because of the lower cost of launch. And I've actually written about this, that the Falcon 9, the rideshare, you know, this $1 million a launch kind of a thing has changed the game in terms of the cost to produce space data. What's ensued from that is a commercial kind of awakening of space data as a utility for other sectors of the economy. I can point to some old ones that are obvious to everybody. GPS was obviously developed as a nuclear survivable navigation in a mutual assured destruction Cold War kind of scenario, right? No one was thinking, oh, this will be great for rideshare companies to someday use. But because it's a space data that's free, it has spawned literally hundreds of billions of dollars in industry. Right, all kinds of companies have emerged because of that one signal. Another one is Landsat data that NASA, NOAA, kind of a NASA NOAA lashup, you know, built and launched these very expensive satellites, by the way. But that data was unclassified and provided, and then that created really that's the genesis of what's now called ag tech, right? Which is a very profitable sector of the agricultural business that leverages space capability. So there was this awakening, and now there's all kinds of proprietary relationships going on that a lot of the space data providers, commercial remote sensing type people are doing. But the and the final thing related to that question, I would say, is that what we're realizing is that the specifications that were flowed down to these suppliers, to the big handful, were very restrictive. And what we're finding is that for low Earth orbit, for a 5-year design life, you can use commercial processors, and they perform perfectly fine, and they're 1/100th, 1/1000th the cost of the same performing processor that's used on these billion-dollar satellites. And so that's been a big deal.
Yeah, it's absolutely incredible what's happening. And I want to back up a little bit. So Chuck, from your perspective, what motivated these new actors to even get involved, and what were the issues they faced? I mean, from my perspective, it had to be a huge challenge to even think about getting started. I mean, we joke about things being challenging to the level of needing rocket scientists, but this seriously involved a lot of rocket scientists.
You know, it's an interesting question that, you know, what challenges did these folks face in the early days? And one of them was revenue model, frankly. And we see that the revenue model for a lot of these companies is still evolving. Many of the folks jumped into this world because they saw problems that weren't getting solved, and they wanted to jump into it and try their hand at it. And we're seeing everything from remote sensing. We're seeing the weather stuff, all these things that both the government is figuring it out, and these new companies are figuring it out. But I think that a challenge that early on that we all faced, because I was a part of this kind of thing, was how to leverage the knowledge base, the skill set of these brilliant engineers and all the technology that was developed, right, by the traditionals, but at the same time shed the bureaucracy, shed as much process as possible while keeping the process that's very useful. Not easy. I think they're still learning that. I think we've come a long way, frankly. Really impressive, this sort of new generation of small satellite companies that are launching today. And another thing that's interesting to note is that many of these companies, in the beginning, these companies were a lot of just crazy grad students and stuff like that, right out of grad school. But there is a huge migration of early to mid-career traditional defense contractor folks that are kind of disgruntled, and they're really excited. You see it, I see it every week. Folks moving from the traditionals into and trying their hand in the much more entrepreneurial world. And that's exciting for both sides, frankly, because the government customer gets the benefit of that. These new companies get the benefit of the bruised knuckles of experience in actually doing this stuff. I know, for example, Blue Origin benefits a lot from hiring folks like that and others. Virgin, same way. I know York, the company that I run, same thing. So,
well, Chuck, I wanted to add on to that because it's a notion that I've thought about quite a bit. And especially when we did a podcast previously talking about DMSP, where they had to replace a failed satellite. I think it was the 11th satellite, and it cost more than the very first satellite that was produced. And, you know, if you were Honda or anybody else and your production model doesn't have efficiencies to where when you're getting into later versions that they don't become cheaper, and eventually it all gets passed along to the taxpayer.
Right. No, that's absolutely right. In the space business I grew up in, when I was in the Air Force and all that, every satellite that was launched was a custom built billion-dollar deal. And now, you know, York, for example, and York is just one among many companies doing this. We make 50 to 100 satellites a year, and it looks like the demand signal is for at least 2 or 3 times that much for next year. And they're all the same. They're all the same components, right? Same drivetrain and chassis. Same what we call a bus. And so that's an exciting thing because you do get those economies of scale, like you said, like a Honda or a Toyota, and that just drives costs that much lower.
Right, and I'm sure that they're not as that custom built version that you described. They can probably do multiple of different things at the same time.
Matter of fact, I use the example. With our line of satellites, a lot of people don't realize this, but with Toyota, there's like 5 different, completely different models of Toyotas that all ride on the same Camry drivetrain and chassis. It's the Camry, the Solera, the Highlander, the Sienna minivan, and 2 or 3 others. I think the RAV4. They're all in the same drivetrain and chassis. That's why you get such incredible value. Incredible amount of, when you think about the amount of technology you get and you buy a brand new RAV4 or something, right? Especially the new hybrid one. It's like, I don't know, $35,000. That's nothing. You don't even get half of us. I mean, you don't even get a cover page of a proposal in our world for that price, right? And they're producing this very complex thing. And satellites are going in that same direction now, finally.
Well, Chuck, thanks again for being here. We really appreciate your insights and really look forward to continuing this conversation. Now, for our listeners, if you want to hear more from Chuck, you can follow his Twitter handle at Chuck Beams. Again, I want to say thanks.
Thank you.
Okay, up next, I'd like to welcome Brigadier General Steve Whitney. General Whitney is the military deputy to the Assistant Secretary of Space Acquisition and Integration. And Steve, I just want to say thank you so much for being with us today.
Hey, Slick, thanks for the opportunity. I'm really excited to be here and share with you and your audience the exciting changes in space acquisition.
Sir, can you speak to the forces that are driving the need for these changes?
Sure, appreciate that. Yeah, you know, the space acquisition environment today is much more dynamic than it has been for the majority of my 28-plus year career. Foundationally, our space acquisitions require upfront investments to work through a large part of the intelligence assessments. And we now have an advantage in the space market due to a rapid increase in competition and commercialization that we can take advantage of as we make those investments going forward. Today's threats in space are evolving rapidly and requiring us to develop rapidly, build, iterate, counter, and protect capabilities. The advantage we never had early in my career is that the commercialization provides us a unique opportunity, and the increased access to space pioneered over the last two decades has broken radically with the space business of the past. For example, in the past, it would have taken years for a company to design, build, and launch a satellite, much less an entire constellation of satellites. With the emergence of small satellites, or also known as CubeSats, many companies can now do this in a matter of months or weeks. I see this competitive advantage, if I look at it from an acquisition perspective, very similar to Henry Ford's assembly line innovation of the early 20th century. You know, he changed the way the world was existing from handmade, custom-built cars to an assembly line function to be able to do that type of production. I see where we're at in the space acquisition world is a similar advent in changing the way we do business. And so now we can capitalize on that in terms of where we're trying to go. And we, the government, need to figure out how we want to do that going forward. The cost drivers for these systems no longer include the challenges of being as complex or difficult to build and integrate systems because of these production lines. And commercialization is allowing us to take advantage of potentially off-the-shelf parts and technologies to incorporate into our smaller sites, resulting in lower costs. All of this technology and improvement helps us get at that pace. That rapid pace of commercialization and change in the space industry competitors, right? Because now not only do we have just the traditional companies, we have a whole host of others that are around to be able to compete for these activities or playing in the market, further spurs on innovation and integration, right? And we are very excited to see all these companies come into the market, right? But that breeds competition, and competition is at an all-time high, whether it be reusable rockets or satellites, right? It all helps us drive costs down because of that competition. Everyone's trying to find a more innovative way to get there faster and cheaper, and that really helps us and helps us get that capability to the warfighter, right? All of this acquisition of competition and innovation and commercialization comes inside of the larger geopolitical construct. The efforts of our adversaries, specifically China and Russia, have changed the space environment from a benign one where we focus primarily on natural phenomena, things such as radiation, zero G, orbital mechanics, to a contested environment that also includes potential hostile actions on top of that. This has redefined how we think about our approaches and given us a sense of urgency. In short, we have to think differently and use the evolution and competition in industry to our advantage. And we're really excited to be able to jump in and take advantage of that.
Yeah, sir, I couldn't agree more. And I think it's really important, as you pointed out, how the privatization really is helping drive that cost down. And, you know, speaking about this
capability for smaller companies to begin innovating in this space. You know, space is one of the most classified realms in our national security enterprise. And the fact that the NRO, the fact that it even existed was not acknowledged for decades. And, you know, we basically boil it down to overclassification impedes space operations, but it's also has a tremendous impact on acquisition, particularly for new entrants. So can you speak to what is being done to address this issue?
Hey, that's a fantastic question. I got to admit, right? I'm still of that old school mindset, right? Even saying the words NRO out in public still gives me a little shiver sometimes. But yeah, it's a great question, and thanks for asking it. You know, classification is an important part of protecting what we do, but the simplification of classification mechanisms surrounding space is absolutely essential for improving our access to the necessary information, both for the warfighter and for the enterprise. In short, we need to protect what is critically important, but we not need to do so in a manner that doesn't just do it in a broad brushstroke. We need to be very selective about what we protect. We need to achieve a balance, right, between what has to be protected and how do we get the information out there. We in the Department of the Air Force are working with the appropriate policy and classification authorities to try and simplify information access and integration across the classifications. Turning to the new entrance portion of your question, I'd like to talk about how we're getting after that by illustrating an example. Out in Los Angeles Air Force Base, the Space Systems Command has a contract mechanism to be able to get on with companies called the Space Enterprise Consortium, or SPEC. This is a great example of how we're encouraging and assisting commercial organizations to better understand DoD acquisition and overall national security space industry. We are approaching space acquisition from this perspective of trying to accelerate partnerships and collaboration with industry in order to identify and adopt those new technologies and processes at a faster pace than ever. Right now, today, the SPEC consortium includes almost 600 members. 70% of those contractual contract vendors, right, are non-traditional partners from small business and academia. Additionally, because we have the standing agreement in place, we've been able to reduce our contract cycle time by about 40% when compared to our traditional methodology. What does this mean? It means that we have a streamlined process that encourages collaboration, innovation, and risk mitigation with our commercial partners. We can get to them faster. We can get to the non-traditional companies, and we can do so all to provide the capability that we need. Another example that I'd like to point out, right, perhaps to think about is SpaceWorks, which is a new unit of the Air Force venture called AFWERX. And they're going to have some exciting efforts right now. AFWERX has been focused very much on how to get after those non-traditional markets. And so they're trying to do so and finding ways to help them get up to speed. Both SPEC and AFWERX are two examples of how we are trying to get after some of those non-traditional companies and assist them in getting over that initial barrier.
Yeah, sir, that is all really great. And it's awesome to see, you know, the reduction in that timeline that you talked about, you know, going down, reducing 40% is huge. But I do want to dovetail into the next question and, you know, go beyond what we've already talked about. So in your view, what else is the DoD doing to encourage more companies to enter and critically stay in the national security space industry? I think if anything COVID-19 has showed us is how some elements of the space industrial base are still fragile, with critical companies and capabilities being at risk of being, you know, bought out by China or other competitors when they're financially in trouble.
COVID-19 has been, what a learning experience it's been for all of us, whether you talk space acquisition or just us in life in general, and how it's completely changed the way we think about things. It helped us all realize how interconnected the world actually is, right? We got so used to, even in our personal lives, being able to go onto Amazon and click and have something delivered in just the next day. And now we're starting to understand at the very personal level what supply chains mean and how shipping costs and delays impact that, right? COVID has been a fantastic example for us to show us that. It's also illustrated for us in stark detail how important it is to manage that supply chain, right? And that's something we take very seriously here. As professional acquirers, right, that's one of our bread and butters, is to manage that supply chain to ensure that we have a robust set of industry partners to safeguard the national security space enterprise. I think there's about three main things that I really kind of classify how we could, or thoughts, if you will, on how we should be looking at this. First and foremost, we have to simplify our acquisition processes to be able to make sure we're getting at the people we need to. We need to try not to, you know, put the bureaucratic lanes in the road, or as we talked earlier, the classification as just barriers, right? We need to be able to try and figure out how to simplify that. Second, we need to identify and maintain what that supply chain is. And we've got a pretty good track for most things. And every once in a while, there'll be a surprise to all of us, right? Who would have thought the problems we're having with, say, microelectronics for automobiles? Or here's an even better one, right? Our rockets are so dependent on liquid oxygen. Well, as we know with COVID-19, liquid oxygen is in tight supply in across the United States to help serve patients. And so we've been working very hard to make sure we can manage that liquid oxygen supply. And finding out, do we need hospital grade, or can we use a factory grade or a lesser pure liquid oxygen level to launch our rockets? And that's been some great work in terms of supply chain management we've done over the last several months. And third, we have to ensure the ability of our companies to compete in space acquisition, right? We can't just limit it to make sure that they have more than a single vendor, I guess is where I'm trying to go at. Make sure they're thinking about who their backup suppliers might be, right? In the future, we must be similar to the way any other one goes about getting things, right? Companies have to bid at the outset on future acquisitions related for the entire life cycle. And we've got to be thinking through to make sure that what it is we're buying, we have the parts for, and we have the supply, the materials necessary to build out that system throughout the entire build cycle, and then also through the entire sustainment cycle of that after it's been put into operations.
Yeah, sir. I mean, you've hit on so many important things, and here's kind of an outlier, but really want to understand what Congress's role is in all of this.
I love talking about Congress. I had the opportunity a few years ago to attend the National War College, and we spent a good several weeks delving into the founding document of our nation, which is the Constitution. And we talked a lot about the roles of the different entities of our Constitution, the different branches, and we talk a lot about Congress, right? Traditionally, everyone talks and they go, oh, this, we, they, da, 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 da. But it's really an incredible partnership. You know, the Constitution lays that out in Article 1, Section 8, for the power that Congress has to provide for the defense and welfare of the United States, and how they have the power of the purse and how they help fund and support the armies and the navies. At the broadest extent, we've got to realize that this is a partnership. It's not a adversarial. It's got to be a partnership between the different branches, just like the founding fathers talked about. And as a military member, right, I got to work with my friends and my partners on the Hill to make sure that I'm explaining appropriately what it is we're trying to do, and that they can then use that to determine amongst the priorities of the nation what it is they need to fund. This partnership has to be founded on transparency and accountability, right? At the end of the day, we're playing with your money, right? We're playing with the taxpayers' money to provide service, the security of the nation, or to provide a service such as GPS, right? We're using the taxpayers' hard-earned treasure to provide a capability, and we need to be able to explain how we're doing that and what we're doing. In partnership, when we answer many of the challenges ahead in this space realm, we've got to work together to do that. And I really look forward to working with Congress to determine how best to implement this space acquisition vision for a more agile and robust enterprise. So in addition, I just want to wrap up this comment about the partnership with Congress. And I really want to thank my partners on the Hill for all they've done over the last couple of years. You know, my entire career has been spent having these conversations about how we should get after this problem and how we should go forward. And they've really helped push that conversation forward in standing up the Space Force and standing up and giving us their direction and their vision for where we should go. And they've been great partners in that, in terms of soliciting our advice and then having discussions with us. And so I just want to take a moment real quickly and thank all of our friends over on the Hill for all that partnership, and look forward to continuing that.
The last thing I wanted to ask you about, sir, because I know our time is getting tight and you have a really busy schedule, but a little bit of alphabet soup with SAF SP and SAF AQS. Can you tell our listeners how the reorganization to bring these two organizations together is going?
Yeah, and to be perfectly honest, I'd rather not talk about boxes and lines on a chart. I'd rather tell you about the capabilities we're getting after and why this is important. One of the challenges the Space Force was asked to address as it stood up was how to better align space acquisition. And what we've created in this new office of the Assistant Secretary of the Air Force for Space Acquisition Integration is a space-focused acquisition organization determined to accelerate and improve our processes. the FY20 NDAA provided that direction to stand up what was known as a service acquisition executive for space programs, and effective 1 October 2022. And so what I want your listeners to think about that is that's the person that decides the direction for space programs. That's the buck stops here type mentality of this is the person that's making the major decisions on our programs. And so our office exists to support them. We've had a couple of good examples how the department is attacking this acquisition problem. One is in our office, as I talked about briefly, as we stand up to support that new assistant secretary and their role as the space acquisition executive. And the other is in the standup of a new field command out in Los Angeles called the Space Systems Command. Together, these two units work together to handle these problems. The standup of our office of the assistant secretary, you know, was covered in the NDAA of FY20, and it said effective 1 October 22. And everyone's talking about that as, okay, here's the date that it's got to be. What we've determined is that's not fast enough. We talked earlier about commercialization and competition and the challenges of our adversaries, and we've got to get going after this now. We don't want to wait till 1 October 22. So Secretary Kendall, a couple months ago, announced this merger of these two organizations to try and get after that problem, to try and set up the office so that when the SAE comes in, we're up and running. Now, that doesn't mean we're just kind of sitting around waiting for a political appointee. We actually do the job today, and we're falling under the Department of the Air Force Service Acquisition Executive over in SAF AQ, and that's Ms. Darlene Costello. And so she's playing that role for us, but we're getting the chance to stand up and make sure we're running as an organization, make sure we're working with Space Systems Command as they field the actual and do the actual program management and acquisition of systems. And we're providing that guidance and direction from the headquarters. I think that's probably the best way to think about it, right? Is these two big changes of this office in the Pentagon and this new field command out in Los Angeles are really the commitment by your Department of the Air Force, your United States Space Force, to get after the space acquisition problem and to start working to do so in a rapid manner.
Well, sir, you definitely are making some headway. And I just want to say thanks so much for taking time out of your schedule to be with us today.
I look forward to hearing the podcast, and I look forward to continuing this conversation as we go forward.
Okay, next, we're going to hear from one company that represents the broader wave of talent that is proving vital to tackling challenges in this new era. And we're honored to have Bradley Cheatham on our podcast today. Now, Brad is the CEO and president of Advanced Space. So, Brad, thanks so much for being here. And to kick things off, can you tell us a little bit about yourself and what your company does?
Absolutely. Yeah. Thank you very much for inviting me. It's really a pleasure to be joining you here today. My background personally is actually as an aerospace engineer, where I specialized in orbital mechanics and was working on my PhD many years ago. And unlike other space company founders like Bezos and Musk, which people might be familiar with, when my co-founders and I decided to start a company over 10 years ago, we didn't have billions of dollars to start with. So instead of building rockets, we decided to focus on building orbits. And so we basically took what was my specialization as an engineer in orbital mechanics, and we started a company to do that work. And Advanced Space is that company. And when we started that company, we really set out with a vision to enable the sustainable exploration, development, and settlement of space. That was really our motivation. And in order to do that, our work focuses on supporting space mission planning and space mission operations. And we kind of break that down just to give you an idea what that means to us. That we think about that as sort of three areas. One of those areas is flight dynamics, we call it. Basically, that means we help people fly their satellites. We help people fly satellites in low Earth orbit to the moon, to Mars, to other planets in the solar system. So kind of across the board. That's one area, flight dynamics. A second area we work in, we refer to as technology development. And this is really where, you know, our vision is a future with a lot of scale and a lot of automation required in space. And so we're creating the capabilities that we think we'll need to support mission planning and operations in the future. And then the third key area for us is what we call rapid mission deployment or rapid turnkey missions. And the best example of this is we have a mission that'll be launching early next year called Capstone, which is the Cislunar Autonomous Positioning System Technology Operations and Navigation Experiment. That's actually going to be a pathfinder for the Artemis program for NASA. We'll be going to the moon, and we'll own and operate that satellite through the entire mission. And so it's something that we're very, very proud of. And so those sort of three key areas are what we do to help the space industry.
Brad, I got to tell you, as a fellow business guy who co-founded a startup, I've got to ask, you know, what were you thinking, you know, to enter this space? And, you know, with all kidding aside, I mean, really entering space as an arena is just absolutely an incredible challenge. And the barriers to entry, the risk dealing with the challenges involving, you know, things like classification, the list goes on and on. What made you want to get into this domain?
That's a great question. And probably, you know, unofficially, I'll tell you, I was pretty naive, right, about what I was signing up for when we started this. But for me, really, what it comes back to, what got me through figuring out, you know, not only how to start a company, but how to support customers in, you know, commercial and national security and civil space, really for me has been driven by our company vision. Really was our motivation for starting the company. And to me, that motivation kind of overwhelms all the other headwinds that you might have in starting any company, but also starting a company in the space industry. And for me, that really comes down to, you know, making what we believe are meaningful contributions to enable a future with people living and working in space, and really helping to deliver value to humanity from space, right? So we do projects that are helping people deploy constellations to provide connectivity to the globe. We support missions that are helping to understand other planets as well as our own planet. I mean, like, these are pretty awesome things to be able to play a role in. And for me, one of those kind of tests that I like to think about is I'm super fortunate to have two little kids at home, a 4-year-old and a 2-year-old. And so I kind of have what I call the toddler test. And every, you know, almost every morning trying to leave to go to work, you know, they want you to stay and play. They want me to, you know, do whatever. And so what I figured out is if I can't make, you know, my reason for going to work resonate with a 4-year-old or a 2-year-old, then I have a problem and I need to restart. So what I found works, at least so far, my kids let me go to work because I tell them really my goal in going to work is to help people go to the moon. That's sort of how I distilled it down to a toddler test, if you will. And so the bottom line for me is I'm really passionate about it, and getting to play a small part in this is exciting to me, and it helps overwhelm all the other things you mentioned that are maybe not so exciting to deal with on a day-to-day basis.
Well, you know, dad having a cool job is always great. And kids are the litmus test. And I had the opportunity to take my 6-year-old to the SpaceX Inspiration 4 launch. And, you know, for him and his world, you know, when I ask him, oh, how was school today? And, you know, what do you want to be when you grow up and stuff like that? It's such a norm for these, you know, 4, 5, 6-year-olds, you know, he believes, he's like, oh, me and my friends, we're going to go to Mars one day. Like, that is a normal thing, in his mindset, which is really cool. And then that's what you all are doing. And, you know, I have to ask what you think, you know, and view your greatest role and contribution is over an expanded, you know, having an expanded roster of players in the industry, you know, in order to provide, you know, better, you know, overarching business models and innovations, in this space.
Yeah, I think that's a great question. And to follow up on the context, as you mentioned, I think, you know, as it may sound maybe somewhat, you know, dramatic or emotional, but I think, you know, there are many generations of little kids that were aspiring to go to space when they grow up. And I think, you know, all the way back to the Apollo program and certainly when I was a kid, I thought that. One of the things I think that's really exciting right now is that, I think it's, from where I sit in the industry, I think it's actually within reach, right? Like people are able to go to space. Maybe, you know, suborbital first is where more people will start going. But I think the idea of there being an alternative way to go to space and to do things in space or to even just work in space, I think that is a super exciting era that we're in. And I think to tie it to the broader question that you had, you know, I think as a company and as a country, we're incredibly lucky to have this industrial base, this really vibrant industrial base that we have here in the United States. I think it's pretty unique. I looked around the world. I don't see it in many other places in the world. But I think the amount of growth and investment and innovation that we have here is really incredible from a space perspective. And I was recently in a meeting. It was pointed out to me that the amount of private investment into the space industry in the last year or so is very close to, if not more than the entire Space Force's annual budget, right? So the idea that there are now privately funded innovations that are really going to make major contributions to the industry is something I think that historically has certainly not been the norm, right? Historically, I'd say DoD and the government more broadly have really been the driving financial resources, at least behind a lot of innovation in the space industry. And I think as we look at, well, what does investment of effectively another Space Force budget in the last year going into a small or going into a variety of sized companies, but really companies trying to solve problems differently, I think that really is going to create a whole new paradigm of opportunity for the industry. And I think that's the type of stuff that's going to get us to, you know, kids being able to grow up and see that future that they all believe. I think there's no reason why we shouldn't have that future. It's just, you know, it's not easy. So I think that that's exciting that the paradigm there is starting to change.
Yeah, no, I couldn't agree more. And in my former business, you know, where as a co-founder, we were doing things that only governments could do. And that's exactly what your company is doing. I mean, previously, there was no private industry that was putting objects into space or maintaining the mission planning or et cetera, other than a government. And, you know, obviously you guys are doing that as a, initially a small business and continue to grow. And, you know, for you as a leader, as a CEO and president, what are you experiencing and seeing as the most important barriers that really have limited you and, you know, other new companies from breaking into this space industry where you're trying to help introduce innovative, you know, things as the national security space technology and capabilities?
Yeah, a great question. And I think, you know, this is a question that is probably going to be different for every entrepreneur and every business. But I think one of the general trends that I've seen is that one of the important barriers really is sort of the mindset, I'll say, of what government partners or commercial partners can think of and how to utilize capabilities. You know, there is a lot of muscle memory in doing things, you know, large contracts to large companies over long periods of time. And I think there are still areas that works and that makes sense. But I think really the new emergent industrial base that we have and the capabilities that brings with it really changes in my mind, what is the art of the possible, right? How can industry and government partner to solve problems? How can we align? I think it's a big thing we see now is that we have not just business alignment with a government customer or government project, but really like our reason for existing as a company aligns with a lot of these projects. And I think that helps a lot. And also I think helps in a somewhat unique way for us as a small company that is aligned with these programs to really have a risk tolerance that is not common and quite frankly, probably not appropriate for larger, more traditional companies. I mean, our ability to take chances and to try new things is, I think, one of the things that really helps us. And from us as a company perspective, I mentioned that sort of, I think, is a barrier from a government customer perspective. From a company perspective, you know, I think there are a lot of unique customer considerations when you talk about the U.S. government as a customer, or the, you know, Department of Defense or civil space agencies like NASA. You know, things like organization structures, very complex, you know, reporting. I'll even say things like acronyms, right? I mean, that is a barrier in sure. Making sure you use the right words for things. And certainly, as you alluded to earlier, I think, you know, security considerations, you know, whether that be classification levels, that be export control, cybersecurity issues. There's a lot there, which are all very important, but they're also, you know, those are, you know, higher and higher walls that entrepreneurs have to figure out how to get over in order to bring their solutions in. And a lot of traditional providers to the government, you know, they built those walls or they helped build those walls. So I think that is a natural challenge for new companies to overcome.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more from my own personal experience and just watching what you all are doing and you know, a lot to unpack in your answer there. But, you know, I really want to focus on as you're a disruptor and you're having to navigate the labyrinth that is, you know, working with the government. You had to, and I assume, you know, being a fellow entrepreneur that,
you've had the conversations, you know, either in your own mind to yourself or to folks that you're teaming with, you know, sitting around the coffee table late at night, and you go, okay, if you were king for a day, you know, what reforms or what changes could be made, or what things would you like to see happen, just to further assist getting new ideas and perspectives into the industry that because of the barriers, you know, wouldn't allow them to happen.
Sure. Yeah. Well, as I reflect on that question, the first thing I have to say is I think if I were king for a day, I'm not sure, you know, procurement or acquisition reform would be the first thing I'd want to tackle. But given the focus of the question, I'll try. I think one of the challenges, building on what I said a minute ago about security considerations, you know, I think if I were king for a day, I would try putting in place a sort of incentive for big procurements and big companies to help bring non-traditional small businesses into, you know, secure conversations or classified conversations. And so I think part of what I would think to try there would be, you know, similar to how we have a small business set aside for contracting in the U.S. government, I think that we should think about having a security clearance set aside requirement where, you know, a big company, large prime contractor would go out and find small businesses and provide them with the initial clearances or the initial, you know, activities to get them into those cleared conversations as some, you know, fraction of their total allocations. I think big, as we've talked about, as the industry is growing, the big picture here is that we need the best and the brightest solving national security as well as civil space and commercial space problems, right? And many of those really smart people who have great new ideas are in small companies, and there is a continuous challenge for small businesses to find a way to obtain security clearances for those that want them. And there are many, quite frankly, that I think are trying to avoid it. And I think keeping those great ideas and those great people out of the solution space is, I think, a big risk. I think obviously these restrictions are important from a national security perspective, but I also think we need, as an industry, as probably also as a nation, a better strategy to get some of these small businesses and non-traditional contributors into the room to find solutions. They're one of the areas we particularly specialize in is orbits around the moon and getting to the moon. And that's a very, you know, high value area to talk about right now. And I'll be just blunt, like we're kept out of a lot of conversations where I know for sure that some of our team members are the most informed in the world on the technical problems that people have. But because of the challenges with security clearances and small businesses and the classification levels of some of these conversations, we can't help, right? And not just set aside the business challenge of that, which is frustrating, but just the fact that I know there are needs that you know our nation has for our skill sets, and these restrictions, these challenges are keeping us from helping. And it's something that we've actually been working on for several years. So it's not necessarily that we just woke up yesterday and wanted to have this conversation. So I think that would be where I'd start in this area is trying to create sort of a set aside program for clearances, just like we do for small business set asides for work. But I think in a bigger picture perspective, this is a challenge. You know, that may not be the right answer, but we got to find a way to get the best people in the room to solve these problems.
Yeah, no, I couldn't agree with you more. And one of the things that you made me remember in the answer to the question was the fact that, you know, I know many, many people that were wearing a uniform, they either separate or retire. And then the next day, you know, they may have had, you know, Mondo, you know, top secrets, you know, security clearance with SCI and SAP access. And then the next day, the government's like, I don't know who you are, you know? Mm-hmm. And if they start a new company based on, you know, years of expertise, they're not allowed into the conversation to your point, just because they simply don't have a clearance, but they may have had it, you know, a couple of weeks ago, which is just bizarre. So the person doesn't change, but just their level of access into the conversation is what changes. And I think that's the door that needs to be opened. So I couldn't agree more. The final thing I wanted to ask you was, there's obviously differences between engaging in civil, commercial, and national security space markets. And from what I understand about you and your company is you participate in all three lanes. Can you expand on what it's like working there?
Absolutely. Yeah, we do participate in all three parts of the market. And for us, we actually count that as pretty important foundation for our business. You know, it's, I'd say traditionally, you know, it was okay to pick one maybe, right? Specialize around what that customer wanted. But for what we do and the services and the solutions we provide, we see that really customers in all three parts of the market, as we see it, have roughly the same needs, right? The words might change, the acronyms might change, but the math is pretty consistent. And so we see that as a key opportunity for us as a company to support our customers in these areas, because, you know, the differences, as you pointed out, things like security considerations, procurement approaches, obviously commercial, you know, contracts are very different than government contracts. There's a lot of differences. But one of the things that we think is important is thinking about what is the same, right? And for us, you know, some of the things that are the same are that there are high standards and high stakes, right? Whether it's a commercial satellite, a NASA satellite, or a DoD satellite, or another agency satellite, right? You have high risk, high reward here. These are high stake things. And so you have to be right. You know, we have to have high quality systems. You can't skimp, you can't cut corners. You know, you have to have a professional team to support it, to enable the work. You know, they all need, you know, very high level and very, very important considerations around security of intellectual property, cyber, et cetera. And so for us, it's really a matter of investing in those things that are the same, and then being able to customize the solutions at the end or the last step for what's unique. And for us, I'll say one of the biggest things we've seen with this mindset is that by thinking about problems where they're common across customers, we're able to, for our customers and our partners, to deliver a really high level of efficiency and speed, right? So for us, we can have a solution where we may have developed it in-house, deployed it first for a commercial constellation of satellites, and then use the same people, the same brain power, the same lessons learned to go support a national security program or a NASA program or another science mission, you know, activity. And for us, that really allows us to accelerate development timelines and to focus. What we talk about is we try to focus on the solution, right? So if we can get to a solution more quickly, or we can automate analysis and software, that's really our big focus. And that's really how we try to differentiate. And so I think that's kind of how we see things as being different. I also wanted to just touch on it for a second, if I can, what you said about the transition of folks out of the military. That's something that we actually spent quite a bit of time working on here and working to be a place that those folks can transition out of. And I think there's some great programs that have emerged there. You mentioned the security clearance issue. That is definitely something we have not solved. But I do think one of the key things for us, and I'd encourage other businesses in the industry to be thinking about this, is to be looking for some of those great folks who have served in the military, who have, you know, incredible discipline, incredible perspective, and are able to come. We have multiple people on our team who have those experiences, and that is a incredibly high value add for a team to have folks with that type of background on the team. So I appreciate that you brought that up, and I think that's a really important topic. We could probably do a whole other podcast on that topic.
No, I totally agree. And, you know, it's just so refreshing to talk to you and, you know, to hear your enthusiasm, your passion for what you're doing, the ethos that, you know, and the culture that you're building for your company, you know, because you just really care about being innovative in the space market, and in companies like yours and leadership like yours is absolutely what's needed. So thanks so much for being here today, Brad. I really appreciate it.
Absolutely. Appreciate the opportunity to join you. Thanks so much.
With that, I'd like to extend a big thank you to you, our listeners, for your continued support and for tuning into today's show. If you like what you've heard today, don't forget to hammer down on that like button and follow or subscribe to the Aerospace Advantage. You can also leave a comment for us to let us know what you think about our show or areas you would like to hear more about. As always, you can join in on the conversation by following the Mitchell Institute on Twitter, Instagram, Facebook, or LinkedIn, and you can always find us at MitchellAerospacePower.org. Until next time, this is John Slickbaum. Stay safe and check six.